This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 16th of September 2014 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Grundig. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design each week here on Monocle 24. I'm your host, Tom Morris. Coming up today, we're staying on home turf and wading up to our waist into London Design Festival. To kick off the show, we meet some of the young designers who are showing their wares here.
I love the idea of the rose being such an unexpected object or image to have connected with military secrecy and this secret room inside a military monument. So that's what drew me to using these.
We speak to some of the headline acts, including the brand new managing director of Artek.
Artek has an 80-year-old identity that has been never compromised.
And then we run into another festival that's taking over the UK capital this month, London Fashion Week, and chat to British-Turkish Cypriot designer Hüseyin Şalayan.
I'm initially moved, let's say, intellectually by something, but then the emotional side also comes into it. So for me, whatever comment I make with the work, it's very important that there is a sort of a heart-brain relationship.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Last week we came to you from Paris's Maison et Objet design show, and as busy as that was, there's no rest for the wicked in the world of design. As the London Design Festival gets fully underway, we're going to devote the first section of this show to the enormous gathering of designers, industry professionals and clients. There are now six design districts located across the city, and over the course of this episode of Section D, we're going to be visiting more than a few of them. First, we're going to head to the spiritual heartland of LDF and of design in London as a whole, the V&A Museum in South Kensington. The museum's opulent galleries are hosting dozens of unexpected contemporary installations this week, as well as contributions from the studios of Zaha Hadid, Sir Terence Conran and Norman Foster. Younger practitioners are also taking centre stage in the most surprising places. Inside the Victorian plaster cast copy of Trajan's Column is the work of ceramicist James Riegler, and David Pleasant ventured in to find out some more.
I am a former artist in residence at the ceramics department here at the museum, and during my time working at the museum, I was really interested in the architecture of the museum and the hidden spaces and overlooked details that you might spot around the building.
We're standing outside a little door. Should we go in? So it's a little door into the column, which is kind of fascinating because it's got a brick structure. It's like an industrial chimney.
I really was really interested in the idea that this is a bringing together of two different aspects of the Victorians. So the outside is a plaster cast of an object in Rome. So if they couldn't take the original, then they'll take a plaster cast. Whereas the inside is essentially a bit of Victorian industrial engineering. We're inside a five-story tall, roughly brick-built cylinder, like a factory chimney, open to the glass roof above us, with some wooden struts supporting the building as it goes up, lined with bookshelves to about a height of about 2.5 metres around the bottom. And I've installed some of my own ceramic objects.
They're kind of graphic designed roses. Tell us about that.
I work a lot with the language of architectural decoration, or maybe traditional architectural decoration, and often with this sense of scale. So these are quite big objects for ceramic objects. They're sort of the size of a big beach ball or something like that, and stylized, as you say, so that they're supposed to feel like pieces of architectural decoration, maybe something that chimes with the monumental plaster cast that we've got outside this little tiny room. They're slipcast ceramics and glossy orange colours. The reason that I've focused on the imagery of a rose, albeit a stylized one like this, as I was researching the idea of secrecy and hidden rooms, and this being a military monument, so Trajan's Column celebrating a Roman victory, I discovered that sub rosa, meaning under the rose, is a clause that's still put on military documents to this day, meaning confidentiality. And it comes from the rose being the symbol of the god of silence, and therefore was hung by the Romans in rooms where meetings were taking place to denote confidentiality and secrecy of the issues discussed underneath the rose. And that continued right the way through to the medieval period and roses painted on the ceilings of banqueting halls, through to plaster ceiling roses that you find in Victorian and older houses now around us in London. So I loved the idea of the rose being such an unexpected object or image to have connected with military secrecy and this secret room inside a military monument. So that's what drew me to using these, albeit on a scale that's sort of unexpected and uneasy, maybe.
We're looking up at these roses that you've described, the way that you've displayed them, the ropes that are hanging. I mean, it's an art installation, perhaps over a design object. How do you look at the commission? And if you're a designer, a ceramicist, presumably producing something that can be bought, what's your thought process in terms of installing, displaying? Is there any kind of boundary at all? Is it all one thing?
I would like to think that there aren't boundaries if you don't want there to be. I mean, I think one of the powers, in my opinion, of coming from a more craft background, so quite skills-based, and I've worked in industry making architectural ceramics for the restoration industry in previous years, I think the power of being based in a material or in a craft skill is that it does allow you to jump between different sides of that art design fence if it exists. I tend to work in perhaps what you might think of as a sort of art way of making installation, but I definitely feel that the aesthetic of the objects I make and maybe the sense of the importance of a sense of use or purpose to the objects beyond just being a piece of sculpture perhaps ties me in my head also to design objects and to the design world. But I think, as I say, I think working with material, I think ceramics has that power to jump across boundaries in a way that maybe other materials don't.
That was ceramicist James Riegler speaking to David Pleasant about the work he's exhibiting inside the Trajan's Column at the V&A Museum. This week is London Design Festival, and the best brands and shops are opening their doors to showcase what is new and exciting in the industry. To seal the deal and celebrate an alliance formed by two of the most iconic design brands, Swiss company Vitra is for the first time showcasing the finished classic Artek in its London showroom. Monocle's Gaia Lutz headed down to the Vitra showroom in the Clerkenwell Design Quarter of LDF to meet Marianne Goebel, Artek's newly appointed managing director, to find out more about the collaboration. Whilst there, she also had the opportunity to chat with Tony Ash, managing director of Vitra, who told her all about how intellectual property laws influence great designers and brands today.
My mission is to keep Artek a separate identity. I think the reason why this will not be difficult is that Artek has an 80-year-old identity that has been never compromised. It's not something that has to be invented now, but it's just something that can be built upon with new opportunities and access to synergies, but nothing that has to be built from scratch.
You talk about synergies. In what specific way will Vitra be collaborating with Artek? Will it be more on a commercial manufacturing side or also in the design side? How do you intend to make that collaboration?
Well, this is what we're currently investigating, but there are obviously fields like logistics, IT, manufacturing to a certain extent, because Artek has also a very strong know-how in wood, and we also have our own factory. But also on the distribution side, we are here today in the Vitra showroom in Clerkenwell Road, where we have an Artek installation, because Artek in the future will be distributed by Vitra UK.
What do you think on both sides? I know you're on the Artek side. The companies can gain from this acquisition. What is the know-how? Do you think that will be passed from one side to the other?
I think for what Artek will pass to Vitra is a certain flexibility and also agility. It's a know-how of the end consumer. Artek runs its own stores, has been running its own stores for 80 years. It has always been very close to the end consumer in direct exchange. I think it's often when a smaller entity comes together with a larger entity, the larger entity sees how you can organize things differently. And it's actually already happening. So my predecessor, Mirku, who was the managing director of Artek before, she joined Vitra and heads the Vitra home segment there now. So there has been a transfer in both directions. Obviously, in the other way, Vitra has an incredible know-how in product development, in manufacturing, in logistics, in distribution. So there are certainly several areas where, as a smaller company, we can benefit from know-how and benefit from synergies.
What is your vision for the company? How do you want to innovate it, I guess? Because I know Artec keeps very close to its core, also by working close to Alto's family, if I'm not mistaken. But obviously, it's always innovating, and it's, you know, a company very much so in the future, as you said. What do you think is the next step of innovation for Artec?
The next step of innovation is to find the contemporary voices we want to work with. Because we have this incredible catalog of classics, and there have been interesting collaborations in the past years, but there has not been a constant product development. There were no ongoing collaborations where with a few designers, whole bodies of works were being built up. And I would hope that as a next step, this is something we can start doing.
And a personal note on the design of Artec furniture is, what has attracted you to them?
Artec furniture has integrity, meaning they have character. They're not trying to please, but because they have character and they have integrity, they are attractive. But maybe not at first glance, you know, I wouldn't say that disturb you, but they intrigue you more at first glance. And the more you look at them, I think the more you love them, because you realize how thought through they are and how honest they are, and they're not pretending to be anything else than a good piece of furniture. And I think that's what attracts me to them.
My name is Tony Ash. I'm the managing director of Vitra for the USA, the UK, Middle East, the Far East, India, and Japan. And we're talking about IP today, intellectual property, which is something that's very important to us at Vitra and Artec, because so many of our designs are classics from the 20th century and, frustratingly for the UK, fall outside of the current IP protection laws. So you might have a piece of furniture made by Alto or made by Eames, which is currently covered by what's called the 70-year law in most parts of Europe, whereas there are only two countries in Europe where that same protection only lasts for 25 years, the UK and Estonia. And we've been fighting quite hard with many of our colleagues in the classic furniture industry to change that. And indeed, the UK government changed that just over a year ago. So we do have a new law now where we have the same protection in the UK as we do in the rest of Europe. However, the law has not been enacted yet, so we're still waiting for the government to actually make this law work, which sadly means at the moment that people can bring cheap Chinese copies of Vitra or Artec products into the UK, and people can unwittingly buying them think they perhaps are original. And worse still, the UK becomes a bit of a Trojan horse for Chinese copies that then can flood into Europe through the UK as an EU member. So we're very keen to change that. It's odd, people don't seem to worry so much about the copying of furniture, whereas a lot of people wouldn't dream of buying a fake Rolex or buying a fake Louis Vuitton handbag or pirated Microsoft software, but somehow it's okay to buy a Chinese copy of an Eames chair or an Alto chair. So we're very pleased that the government has done what they've done thus far, but we really need them to finish the job, enact the law, and then it will be a criminal offence to copy our products in the same way as a criminal offence to record a movie in a movie theatre or to pirate music.
That was Gaia Lutz speaking about the business and intellectual property laws that surround design brands with Managing Director of Vitra, Tony Ash, as well as Artec's new Managing Director, Marion Gerbel.
For over six decades, Grundig has made people's lives better and simpler. To this day, we bring our expert knowledge of design and technology to a wide range of high-quality domestic appliances. Whether refrigerator or radio, oven or audio system, we continue to integrate our manufacturing heritage with state-of-the-art technology. Grundig synthesizes the best of yesterday with the best of tomorrow, expertly and innovatively designed for you and your home. Grundig. Supreme engineering, timeless design.
You're listening to our LDF special here on Section D with me, Tom Morris. Now, for a lighter, more indulgent look at what's being open this week and put on show, our producer went down to Soho. Max Arrowset and a small team from ALA Architects have not only ventured into restaurant design, something that's new to them, but have also taken on the delivery and management of what is their own restaurant concept. Tin Can is a small, stylish space devoted to the world of eating canned food. despite getting a bad reputation in many places, including the UK. In Spain and Portugal, people have long known that the most simple and delectable of seafood lunches can be had by simply cracking open a tin. David Pleasant went down to Soho to meet the architect and now restaurateur, who has what many might call a can-do attitude.
My name is Max Arrowset. I'm one of the directors at ALA, and we're sitting in Tin Can, a brand new restaurant that we've opened in Soho. It's a short-term project, but we're very excited about it.
We are surrounded by hundreds of colourful, assorted tin cans. Tell us a bit about the idea, how it all started.
It all started with one of our projects. So we're doing a cultural center for EDP, who are an electrical company. They have a foundation, and we've been working on the project for over 4 years. So we've spent a lot of time in Lisbon, and in those trips to Lisbon, we discovered, you know, having to eat out a lot, we discovered one of the delicacies that they have is actually this tin seafood. Some of them are gourmet, some of them are more, you know, more simple than that. But there are two things that really attracted us. Number one, the packaging was great. So we found that a lot of the packaging wasn't, not only retro packaging, but some of the contemporary packaging is really, really, really appealing.
And that's, I mean, it's striking as you walk in, just the variety, the different designs, the kind of effort that the manufacturers have put into this very simple products. But I mean, maybe describe some of the tradition of the packaging that you've come across.
The packaging is actually a real reflection of the amount of work that goes behind some of these products. So one of the things that we're challenging with this, and that's why we wanted to heighten, you know, make an object of desire, these cans, is that a lot of these tins have real preparation and a lot of years of work and tradition to create the product. So some of them even have chefs behind them that, you know, actually work with them to choose what olive oil they put in it, at what temperature the tuna has to be put into the tin, and so on. There's real effort and work behind it. Nothing that we have here is what you can get in a supermarket. I mean, they're all mainly family-run businesses that, you know, take care about their graphic design, take care about the product that they do, and so on. We're slowly working our way into integrating from tins from all over the world, to be honest with you. So hopefully we'll get some Japanese ones soon. We have some British ones on the pipeline that we would also like to include. But it all depends on the quality. You know, at the moment, the best quality we find is this. But hopefully, because some of the products are seasonal, they will be rotating. So
seasonal, and yet, surely the point of the tin is that it lasts a considerable amount of time.
I mean, I think they need to put 5 years in the tin because that's, I think it's an EU regulation kind of thing. But actually, there's no reason. They just last forever, really. As long as the tin is not compromised, I mean, it's not an issue. What we mean by seasonal is because some of the product actually runs out very quickly, and because you can only capture that fish on those certain months, then when they're out of stock, they're out of stock. So, you know, that's why I mean the season. And also, we also think it's interesting that the menu rotates throughout the year, so that if you're really passionate about seafood, you can always come in and find a surprise.
Maybe let's describe the design, the interiors here. So you've really kind of let the tins dominate, and really you've given them center stage, as it were, on these rods. They're just placed. I mean, you could actually just pick them off, but you've put them up very neatly. Tell us a bit more about the choices, the tables, the lamps.
Sure. So the first thing is we wanted to elevate the tin, as we said, and we in our architecture we always work with repetition and, you know, just minimum changes to that repetition, so you can see that they're kind of zigzagged, and, you know, obviously that's perfectly done. But then the backdrop, we wanted the backdrop to be dark, so we actually went for a black Corian backdrop, because it's a little bit abstract, you know, to have these colorful tints in this black backdrop kind of floating in space, if you want. The only thing that we've left original from the store is the floor, because we were quite lucky to get a nice herringbone.
Okay, oh, herringbone. Yeah,
herringbone pattern, so that was quite lucky of us. But yes, we wanted the tin to actually be the main actor, if you want, in this theatrical setting, if you want. And then we've actually designed everything in a really short term, so a lot of the things that you see here for us are nearly like prototypes. So the tables, the stools, everything was designed literally in 3 weeks. Same as the lights, so the lights are also our design. We worked with LG, they kindly supplied OLED, so we're working with their new technologies, and we literally designed and built everything in 3-4 weeks. So we're very excited about that.
Apart from considering that the tins and the concept of the restaurant, I mean, what other kind of considerations do you go through as an architect, as an interior designer? I mean, have you done many restaurants before? Is it something that was new to you?
Well, it's actually quite new to us, because the type of areas in the industry that we've worked were more commercial. And here we actually just wanted to have a space that would allow us to enjoy it, really. Because it's a fun project for us. It's going to be short term, 6 months. So for us, it's more nearly friends and family coming over, more than really looking at it as a business, to be honest with you. We're hoping to also have great nights in Soho with friends and family and people that we collaborate with. And that was the main driver. So we've been really lighthearted about, you know, the design. We just, you know, we've done something that we like, but we it's been more a fun project. It's really nice to be your own client for once, you know, and invest in yourself and in your own ideas.
If we finally go back to the tins, if you have some recommendations, if someone's going to come and visit, what are some of the best tinned products that you serve?
So, I mean, obviously this is a personal taste, but I was really surprised with the cod liver. I mean, I was a bit reluctant to try it the first time, but the texture is very similar to foie. It's great, and apparently it's great for you. It's got loads of omega-3, so that's a plus. I also really enjoy the baby squid in their own ink. Maybe because I'm Spanish and it's quite a traditional Spanish plate, but it's an intense taste. It's very, you know, if you like seafood, you'll definitely like it. We have a product which is a little bit like Marmite. 50% of the people hate it, 50% like it, which is the sea urchin caviar. I love it. I would travel distances to eat it, but there's a lot of people that, you know, it's a strong taste for them. It's hard for me to choose because, you know, I've actually been curating all of them, so I like all of them, but definitely those three would be the ones that I would recommend.
That was David Pleasant speaking to Max Araset of ALA Architects in their temporary restaurant space Tin Can in London, Soho. Still to come today, we'll be paying a visit to the brand new office space of Makita Eyewear in Berlin, talking about the politics of fashion with sometimes controversial designer Hussein Shalayan, and checking into a hotel room that happens to be around a famous statue in Helsinki, and then going to the shores of the Bosphorus to find out what it is that makes for the perfect Turkish summer house. Berlin eyewear brand Makita is known for its innovative frame shapes and its collaborations with fashion-forward designers. But it's also dedicated to the idea of modern manufacturing, merging high-tech and handicraft, and producing everything under one roof. Success has pushed the firm beyond the boundaries of its Berlin headquarters, sending it sprawling into neighbouring apartments and offices. The company has just moved into a new space that offers a perfect union of industry and aesthetic, as well as room for the ambitious company to continue to grow. Susan Stone visited the new Makita House for Section D.
This five-story neoclassical building has long been known as the Pelican House, after the German writing supplies firm that spent close to four decades located within its walls. That name and a golden pelican still glitter from the facade. The day I visit, the word Makita in neon is being added in the entryway that leads to an Art Deco-style tiled courtyard. It's filled with workers setting up a sound system and barbecue for a housewarming party. 100 years ago or more, this area was Berlin's first industrial and transit quarter, explains Makita PR manager Lisa Tam.
We're here in Kreuzberg in Ritterstraße, so Ritterbutzke is next to us. Now it's a very famous club, but before it was Ritterwerke. It was also one of the first manufactories. Like, the whole street was an economic center, and from here all goods were kind of shipped out into the whole wide world.
The 5,000 square meter building is double the size of the old Makita House. There's now room for its 220 workers, doing everything from lens polishing to lookbook shooting, as well as space to grow.
So we're crossing the courtyard of the Makita House. As you can see, the facade is a very nice mixture of green and beige tiles. And we put up some industrial lamps here. But basically, our philosophy is to always keep the spirit of the place. So we didn't want to change too much because we actually really like that industrial feeling here.
As we enter the back building, a handful of workers sit at a desk, fully focused on fine sheets of metal. They're punching out and shaping front pieces of frames, including one from Makita's newest designer collaboration with Maison Martin Margiela. The micro-thin, powder-coated stainless steel piece will be bent and folded 11 times to ensure a perfect fit. It's from the Essential line and has no additional parts, no nose pads or earpieces. The finished frame will weigh only about 8 grams.
Beauty and technology is a little bit our topic.
That's Makita co-founder and chief executive officer, Moritz Kruger. The company name comes from the building where it was founded, a former Kita, or kindergarten. Maikita's under one roof philosophy means that the roof itself is rather important.
The Pelikan House, or the Maikita House now, has a very nice architecture because it's extremely transparent, so it's a lot of glass on the facade. It was planned by the architect Kurt Berndt, who also did the Hackische Höfe, for example. So it's an industrial architecture, yeah, with a lot of transparency. And this is actually what made it also so perfect for the use as a Maikita house.
Natural light streams through the workspace windows, making the ruby-red temples for a round acetate frame called Sousa gleam as the company's patented hinge system is inserted in each piece with the aid of pressurized glue.
We define ourselves as a modern manufactory. When you're looking back in the history of the classic manufactory, that means that you bring different expertise from different fields under one single roof and in order to create new, more complex products. Then this was always the most important part of our DNA. I think that especially like this building in the Ritterstraße is reflecting like an industrial history, and in the same time, I think it's in a very interesting, fast-moving part of the city.
Kruger's fourth-floor office overlooks tower block apartments with a slightly Soviet feel. Colorful sun umbrellas and satellite dishes sprout from balconies. He says the move to Kreuzberg from their comfortable spot in Mitte has pushed Maikita out of its comfort zone and provided fresh inspiration. Up the street, neglected, unattractive Moritzplatz is starting to bustle with ever-increasing numbers of creative workers and the supplies and services to support them. One such company, retail and design agency BAM, and its fashion blogs High Snobiety and Selectism, have moved into the Maikita House's top floor as subletters. In most parts of the city, Berlin's past as a strong manufacturing center feels distant. Maikita itself developed its production processes out of necessity when they couldn't find anyone to make their glasses. Design and materials innovations helped Maikita make their mark in the competitive eyewear field. In Berlin, the company is a singular reminder of what might be possible again for industry.
When we've been in Mitte, I don't know, in Kreuzberg now, but we've been the biggest company in the manufacturing business, which was quite weird when we heard it, but I mean, it makes sense. There's no companies who are like in the center of a metropole and producing goods.
Maikita's efficient and clean production fits into the neighborhood without disturbing residents, with the exception of that housewarming party, perhaps. By reintroducing manufacturing into the city center, they may set an example others could follow. As Maikita workers put the final touches on some of the nearly 1,000 frames they produce each day, the glasses are given a last polish, then snapped securely in their cases. The brand remains in motion. Maikita will introduce optical frames from the Margiela collaboration and several other models later this month during Paris Fashion Week and the Slimo Eyewear Fair. For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Susan Stone.
As London Design Festival rolls on, another industry jamboree is simultaneously taking over the British capital, London Fashion Week. As the shows and parties continue, it's perhaps worth taking stock of the more serious or perhaps more political side of fashion. On the occasion of a new exhibition at Toronto's Design Exchange, called The Politics of Fashion, The Fashion of Politics, which is guest curated by Jean Becker and contains visionary works from the archives of Moschino, Alexander McQueen, Stella McCartney and Vivian Westwood, and also a short film by fashion designer Hussein Shalayan. Always at the cutting edge of fashion design, Shalayan's dresses became known in the 90s for their extraordinary shapes, technical dimensions and underlying message of subversion. David Pleasant sat down with the designer to find out if he always sets out to cause controversy.
For me, I always really try and tell a story. I really call myself a storyteller with clothes. And I don't think my main preoccupation is to provoke as such. I think it's more that I see generally creativity as a tool to create new perspectives or to make you think of something that you didn't think of before, or even highlight blind spots or even comment on something. And so I thought, why not use fashion as a tool to do these things? And I think this was always my approach. And it wasn't really a case of doing it for the sake of provoking or for the sake of even being political. But if I was moved by something politically, or I was moved something by something, let's say, also in an emotional way, I would make it part of my work. And often I think that, you know, I'm initially moved, let's say, intellectually by something, but then the emotional side also comes into it. So for me, whatever comment I make with the work, it's very important that there is a sort of a heart-brain relationship.
And has that, the result of that kind of process, would you call it the end result? Would you call it subversive? Do you consider yourself a subversive fashion designer?
I don't know what to call myself, really, honestly. I think it's about really creating an image of the body that can in some way be, let's say, inspiring. It could be negative, it could be positive as well, but as long as it has some reaction. And I think that the clothes for me are a tool to essentially really adorn the body and empower the body, really. That's my main kind of concern. But there could be these sort of themes and ideas running through which could take it further. But like I said, I don't really do it every time and all for the sake of it. And sometimes it's more of an abstract idea. So I would never say that I'm sort of a political designer per se. So it's just that there have been themes that I've applied that have been political, but not every time.
So maybe let's talk about some of the times that you have chosen to go down that road for whatever reason. So if we talk about the short film and aesthetics, maybe introduce some of the themes in that film.
Well, I am essentially a designer and also work as an artist. But again, I hate these labels because I'm essentially really an ideas person. But my main discipline is fashion design. And of course, I do other things as well. But they're all part of the same worldview. And Anesthetics was a film made up of 11 chapters. And it was comment really on experiences in the world that I see as situations which have a sense of disembodiment, or that pain through institutional codes are tamed or are obscured or controlled. And each section, each chapter in the film is really a comment on, for instance, flight and the disembodiment that you can experience in flight, or how in-flight service is to make you forget that you ever left the place, as if you've continued your daily activities but on a plane, which in a way anesthetizes you from the violence of flight, because essentially I see it as quite a violent kind of experience. Or maybe the experience of a cesarean section, that is quite a violent thing, but there's a screen in front of the patient and you never really see what's going on, and you just handed the baby's handed over to you. So there are lots of things I think around us that in a way, what I call it, like anesthetized experiences, in order that you can cope with violence and pain. And this film, Anesthetics, is really about that. But the characters in Anesthetics is really the same characters that you'd also see in my fashion shows, so to speak. So I think it's really part of the same worldview. And what's been very interesting in my case is that I've had art collectors that collect these films, and often I've funded my fashion work with that income. So there's been this really interesting kind of model that I think doesn't really happen in fashion very often.
That leads to my next question, actually, because obviously you've said you don't want to be labelled as just a fashion designer or artist or designer or whatever, but still, as in the world of fashion that you're mainly preoccupied by, these kind of really hard themes, political, intellectual or otherwise, it's quite a hard pitch to somebody who's maybe just wanting a really beautiful dress. Or is it the particular kind of person you have in mind who wants to invest in your thought process as well? Or is it you feel like you've got your own name now, your own brand, that you've got free reins? Or are you ever thinking, actually, I've got myself so removed from fashion now with whatever kind of theme or whatever that you're thinking about? Does that ever go through your head, or do you find it completely organic?
So, David, your question is a burning issue. Yes, I actually participate within a fashion discourse, but because of the cross-disciplinary nature of my work, I have had many connections with the design world, art world, architecture world. I've lectured a lot in architectural schools, especially. And essentially, actually, like I was saying, I am an ideas person, but I am mostly, acting as a fashion designer. And I like that. And I'm proud of that. And the ideas that I'm talking to you about, for instance, within anesthetics, those ideas are slightly the sort of the world around the clothes, and the clothes might be designed in that spirit. But actually, those themes I'm talking about aren't necessarily always relating to the design, but they may relate to the environment I'm trying to create around the clothes. So I may have equally abstract ideas that inform the clothes, but actually the way I think of the world is, and especially if you're a designer, the richer the ideas are, the more they can lead to a richer product. And actually that's the reason why I construct these ideas, that I feel at the end they're not supposed to, sometimes they're used as an inspiration to create the film or to create a show, a live show. But actually, I find often that the richer my ideas are, the better the product is, because it leads to a research process that I couldn't have created without these ideas. And then that process then creates ingredients for me, which enriches the design. So actually, there is this interplay between the final result and the ideas.
That was our producer, David Pleasant, speaking to fashion designer Hussein Shalayan.
Grundig believes that televisions should provide more than entertainment. They should connect you with your world. Its state-of-the-art smart LED TVs allow you to unite with friends via Skype, watch over a sleeping child next door with baby cam, or control access to the internet through your mobile phone. Grundig is committed to investing in the best technology, digital innovation, and superlative design to help you bond with the world from your own home. Grundig. Supreme engineering, timeless design.
You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris. And now we're going to go to Finland's capital, Helsinki. Every city has statues. They are often taken for granted or ignored as people race past them to get from A to B. The Japanese artist Tatsu Nishi is known for transforming people's perceptions of public spaces by constructing private ones. And now he's brought his up-close and personal approach to public space to Helsinki and to one of his most famous statues. Nishi decided to work with the Havis Amanda Fountain, which overlooks the Market Square by the harbour. His plan? To transform it into a hotel. Mark Bosworth went along to take a look.
Havis Amanda has stood above this water fountain with fish and sea lions spouting water at her feet since 1908. Sculpted by Ville Valgren, she's a mermaid, but her nakedness and seductiveness were considered inappropriate and caused a stir when she was first unveiled. Attitudes have changed, though, and today the statue is one of the most popular in Helsinki, with locals affectionately referring to her as Manta, which is why Tatsu Nishi called his work Hotel Manta. Maija Tanninen-Mattila is the director of the Helsinki Art Museum, and she's been interested in Nishi's work for some time.
We decided to invite him here to Helsinki. He travelled here in the spring, and we walked around Helsinki and showed him our public sculpture. And he fell in love with Havis Amanda and proposed to build a hotel room around her. And we said yes, and here it is.
What attracted him to Havis Amanda in particular?
I think it was the idea of giving a room to a naked lady. He talked a lot about Helsinki being a sexy city also. So I think that Havis Amanda as a nude sculpture, she's very sensual, quite erotic, and she did arise some... There was a lot of talk around the sculpture when it was first unveiled about the unseemly way she depicted Helsinki as a nude woman. The suffragettes were demonstrating on the streets of Helsinki against her. And I think that Tatsu Nishi wanted to comment on the sculpture's past as well.
What do you think about Havis Amanda being covered up?
It felt a bit weird at first, but I guess it's quite nice. People have been going there and it's a bit different, so people pay attention to it. So,
not sure. Okay, I'm not sure.
Very stupid idea.
A stupid idea?
Yes.
Why?
Because the Manta itself is very beautiful.
You're upset that she is covered up, but would you be tempted to go and visit Amanda, see her face to face on the bed?
I'm not. I'm not interested in it.
I think that's pretty ugly. I don't like it at all.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I like the statue, and I'm so sorry for that they have covered it.
I have sort of mixed feelings about that. In a way, I don't like it. You know, I would like us and the tourists to see the Haavis Amanda when they come here. This is so central piece of place in Helsinki. But then on the other hand, I also want to support the modern art and the way they try new things. So, you know, it's going to be there a little while and then they take it away. Why not?
So mixed feelings from Helsinkians, with some not liking the fact that Manta's been covered.
I think this is a very important part of this whole project, is to make something which is everyday to people special. I mean, wasn't it Schopenhauer who said that we appreciate things like beauty and youth when they're taken away from us? And I think that this is the way that Tatsunishi works. He reminds us that, hey, the city is full of public sculpture, it's free art, there's a whole museum in the city. Actually, Helsinki has over 200 public sculptures which belong to the collection of the City Art Museum, and we take care of these works. And sometimes I think the public need reminding that we have joint ownership of these works of art. We need to look after them, and we need to appreciate them. And sometimes, you know, taking something away from the public is a good way of reminding them.
The statue, it actually pops up in the middle of the double bed in the room. It's pretty unusual.
It does, and you need to choose which side you spend the night with her. And it's a double bed, so it's a choice to make. She is very erotic, and I think it's interesting because Ville Valgren was a fantastic sculptor. Haavis Amanda is 106 years old this year, and Ville Valgren, he sculpted her in Paris. He used French models, 19-year-old ladies, young ladies, and I think that the sensual way that Ville Valgren has depicted her face, for example, will be a surprise to people when they go to look at her so close, because from the street level you can't see the way that she smiles, you can't see her eyes, and this is an opportunity to do that.
The guests are just coming out of their room down the stairs. Hi, what's your name?
I'm Richard.
Richard, and?
I'm Simo.
Simo, okay. So how was your night?
Pretty good. We had a threesome with Manta, so it was okay.
And how was it sharing a bed with Manta?
Yeah, that was fun. It was a bit noisy, but it was really, really nice.
What, noisy from the traffic?
From the traffic, yeah.
You're not Manta. Manta was a quiet one. So.
She behaved, did she?
She behaved, yeah. She was a bit shy. She has this look as well. She behaved.
Was it strange sharing a bed with a statue?
Yes. Especially in the morning when you woke up. Yeah. But, I mean, you got quite used to it.
What was it about the room that attracted you in the first place?
The view, definitely. And the big window that everyone can actually look inside the room. And that was fun.
What about for you? What was that actually like to be in such a room, which is obviously full of pretty nice design objects as well?
Pretty nice, but I think it's so strange. It's on top of a fountain, and there's a statue in between or in the middle, and you're always seeing the middle the statue. While I've lived here for all my life, I've never been that close to Manta, so I think that was the greatest thing. And Manta is actually much smaller than I thought. She's almost like a human size, just a bigger, and then has a good bum.
Oh, really?
Yeah, pretty good bum, yeah.
So the sculptor did a good job.
Yep. Oh yeah, definitely.
Well, now that the guests have left the room, I can pop in for myself and take a look. Wow, well, as soon as you walk into this room, the atmosphere and ambience is so, so different to the hustle and bustle of the streets outside, into this light, airy room, which is full of design items from Finnish designers. There's bedside lamps by Maira Gulliksen. There's a table by Ilmari Tapiovaara, and these lovely tank armchairs by Alva Aalto. And if you walk around, the whole room is covered in this fantastic red and white wallpaper. It was actually designed by Tatsunishi himself, and he's actually used images of important historical figures. There's the National Poet Laureate Runeberry, there's Elias Lönnrot, who collected the stories of the Kalevala, the national epoch of Finland. There's Alexander II, there's the Maiden of Finland with a Finnish flag. And then, of course, you have a sauna next to a lake, all these classic images. But of course, the main attraction here is here, stood in the middle of the double bed, Haavis Amanda. And it's an incredibly strange experience to be stood here on the bed now, face to face with Haavis Amanda, as she gazes out of this huge window to the harbour of Helsinki, as the sun glistens on the Baltic Sea and the giant ferries which head off to Stockholm leave this harbour side, and the city around us wakes up for another day.
That was Mark Bosworth checking out Helsinki's Haavis Amanda statue, which is until October surrounded by a hotel bedroom. With summer fading all too quickly into autumn, let's go now to Turkey. A gallery in Istanbul has just unveiled a new exhibition examining the role of summer homes in Turkish society. Since the days of the Ottoman Empire, summer houses, as opposed to hotels or resorts, have played a big role in how Turks spend their holidays. Far from a simple city escape, the history of the Turkish summer house tells the story of some of the country's most important architectural advancements. Monocle's Joseph Dana met with the curator of Summer Homes Claiming the Coast at the Szolt-Biogyu Gallery for a tour of the exhibition and a discussion of the meaning of owning a home for summer retreats.
I'm Mary Turner. I work for Szolt Research and Programs. I'm one of the associate directors. The exhibition is called Summer Homes Claiming the Coast in English. The summer homes in Turkey, they have a long history. First of all, the exhibition shows that, but there's in fact an understanding if you travel to south, especially to the Aegean coast, you can easily spot that there's a great agglomeration of houses that define this term yazlık, which is summer homes, but it's also an environment in itself. And they have gone to a peak in the 80s and 90s, and I think almost all middle class living in cities, they had purchased this dream of having a leisure time, but in a house. But the story of the 80s and 90s, which are in fact of housing developments, big complexes of many houses that sit together on the same ground, there's in fact a backstory to it. And so the exhibition considers this, let's say, output in different dimensions. One of the threads is architecture, because it's really easy to read the whole story through architecture. And another very important factor that helps or sometimes could have avoided some of these developments is the law, and how architecture is always, in fact, embedded within the system, the authority. And the third dimension we have, I think, entertainingly and engagingly used is literature that is developed around these costs and this idea of a summer home.
When we walk in, there's this really interesting, almost captivating layout of the Bosphorus. Is that what we're looking at with the golden horn on the right?
That's correct. That's a map of Istanbul from 1918. When you do urban studies on the city, there are quite a few very famous maps that help us to understand the structure of the city. And this one is a very little known map. These are usually insurance maps, but this was developed for that same purpose. And the little orange pieces that we put, which represent the houses along the Bosphorus, are, you can read on them very easily. These maps are always in both in Ottoman and in French script, and this one is in French so that we could understand a bit. Otherwise, it's the Arabic lettering. So this you can easily see. These are all high-ranking officials' summer homes. Some of them are palaces to the Ottoman Empire, small palaces, and some of them are houses for the elites.
So we've moved away from the Ottoman origins of this idea of summer homes, and we're moving into, now this is the early Republic, the 1950s or so?
Let's say with the White Russians moving down to Istanbul, they start to swim in swimming suits, which is not the traditional way of using the water during the Ottoman. In the Ottomans, they had what they called sea hammams, These were structures that were enclosed, but so men and women would be separated, but this was a way of taking a bath. It wasn't about swimming, in fact. So this change, this shift in Istanbul, comes with the migrating white Russians. So they started using Florya as the first place for swimming, I mean, men and women together. And so the understanding of Istanbul as a summer village, not the core, but the periphery, is meant to be. And I think the perception for the people living at that time is that it is a summer home. It is a summer town for everyone across Turkey, which is quite different than what we traditionally know when we think of Istanbul. I mean, we're going to, in fact, now visit a section where we will see the preliminary, let's say, the summer homes that are in between these times. So these are the summer homes of architects or of people who were commissioned by architects between 1930s and 1980s.
We're standing in front of what looks to, it looks like it's a big cutout of a boat or something. What yes, exactly are we yes. looking at?
This is a floating home, and this floating home was actually, this is of course a model of a one-to-one scale, like you said, a section. So these were built in the 1930s. There's this talk of owning summer homes, and Istanbul, the city, is so small and the land is so sparse. You can dream of building one, which would be the case that it would be quite cheaper to build one home instead of renting one. So this goes with this little short text where the architect is in fact encouraging people to make their own floating homes and being able to travel in between the little beaches that would be favored around, especially on the Anatolian side.
So I have to ask, do you have your own summer home experiences?
I grew up in one of those that I spent all my summers in one particular place in Kuşadası. And this transformation that Turkey had gone through in 80s and 90s, a financial transformation that kind of changed the whole structure of the society, I think, is much more obvious, I think, in the summer home, because you would go to a place where maybe there wouldn't be running water and that would be okay. So all these things that you were deprived of did not really matter so much.
That was Monocle's Joseph Dana visiting the Summer Homes exhibition in Istanbul. And that's all we've got time for today on this week's Section D. It was produced by David Pleasant and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact the producer David at dmp@monocle.com if you'd like to feature on the show or if you've got any comments or questions. I'm Tom Morris. I'm playing you out in a tribute to that great museum, the V&A, that we heard from at the beginning of the show. Let's go back to that neck of the woods with Nick Cave and the Bad Seas and Brompton Oratory. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.
Up those stone steps I climb, hail this joyful day's return. Into its great shadowed vault I go, hail the Pentecost.